I'm going to talk this morning about transient neutron star class. Try to explain to you an observational rubric that has come to the fore in recent years, describe what can be done with that. This work I've done observationally with Lars here, as well as Brian in Chicago, joined Pavlov and Garstov's office. Basically, what I'm going to tell you, in a nutshell, I like to give away everything at the beginning, is that there's a source of energy, deep crustal heating, in the transient neutron stars, which has been previously neglected. And this energy release can account for nearly all of the quiescent luminosity. This wasn't appreciated until recently. On top of that, the spectroscopy of the neutron stars, when you use a realistic hydrogen atmosphere rather than a black body atmosphere, has been used previously. It's consistent with emission over the entire neutron star surface. And so this can potentially, given things work out favorably in an observational sense, be used to measure the neutron star radii in these kinds of systems.
I missed the second sentence.
So the idea is that, using realistic hydrogen atmosphere spectra or whatever the appropriate spectrum is for neutron stars, they can be used to measure their radii. That's not really a new idea, but the realization that there are neutron stars which are in a particular state which lend themselves to that kind of analysis is useful. So first of all, it's good to review what a transient is. Transient is a usually low mass echo binary for the systems that we're interested in. They are usually discovered by brightening very suddenly in the X-rays. They get to luminosities around 10 to 37, 10 to 38 ergs per second. This is understood to be disk instability, just the standard thermal instability where the surface density gets too high. You have a neutron star, which is in orbit around a normal sort of, or slightly evolved sort of low mass star, which is orbiting like its Roche lobe, and the matter which is falling out of the Roche lobe is accumulating in the outer part of the accretion disk, which eventually becomes unstable, drops all the matter onto the neutron star. That occurs over a time scale of about weeks to months in these systems, after which the neutron stars are observed to decrease in luminosity to somewhere below 10 to 34 ergs per second. We have observation limited in many of these systems, so those are really detected. This is an example of one of these transients. It's one of my favorite ones, called a rapid burster. This is axis is in time and days. This axis is counts per second taken in the XTEL sky monitor. And it's a pretty standard sort of light curve for a neutron star transient of this type, generally consistent with zero in the sky monitor for this particular source for about 6 months. It goes into outburst, brightens on the time scale for about a day, and then has something kind of like an exponential decay, which drops down over time scale about 15 days or so. And that's pretty standard. This particular one is one of the more active transients, and there's another one that's semi active about 6 months. But most of the transients have outburst recurrence time scales of more like years to decades, as they have been observed. The neutron stars that we're interested in, at least for what we're talking about today, are identified by their type 1 X-ray bursts. These are the thermonuclear flashes on the surface of the neutron star. This also tells us, at least phenomenologically, that they are likely to have very low magnetic fields. That's because, if you're familiar with the history of these things, first there's no pulse, and pulse there's no burst. Their magnetic fields are just thought to be typically very weak, somewhere below, say, 58 Gaussians. So this is one of the question mark sources. One has to also worry about whether or not one is looking at a black hole. And so knowing that one is seeing a type 1 X-ray burst from the system pretty firmly determines that one is looking at a neutron star.
When you talk about the transient and when you talk about the burst, is that the same thing?
No.
It's not?
No, it's not. This is all due to accretion. The accretion suddenly turns on when the disk starts falling onto the surface. Well, the disk starts traveling in towards the surface of the neutron star and it drops matter onto the surface of the neutron star. The burst is a type of X-ray burst, which is a helium flash just under the surface of the neutron star.
But how do you distinguish them observationally?
By the time scales. The type 1 X-ray bursts occur and last for about 10 seconds. They have about 10 seconds. These photon bursts last for 10 seconds. And so what we see is the net very X-ray flash about 10.7 meters per second, and all of the X-ray flash between two type 1 X-ray bursts going off every few hours, 2 days or something. That cannot happen otherwise because you have to have fresh matter accreting onto the neutron star in order to provide the material to go through the thermonuclear flash.
Okay. So there's no accretion going on in quiescence?
Well, that's a good question, right? So I'm going to address that a little bit. So the first neutron star in quiescence, down below 10 to 34 ergs or so, was discovered in 1987. It had a luminosity it measured at the time of around 5 to 32 ergs per second for the distance, which was measured within a factor of 2 or so, factor of 4. And understood as a black body, the radius was measured to be about a kilometer for the distance known. It's rather small for a neutron star. And the temperature is about 0.2 keV. It was curious, actually, when it was first discovered, because these are low-mass X-ray binaries. The companions are low-mass stars, so their ages are probably on the order of 10-8 years or so. But neutron star cooling curves tell us that the neutron stars should cool on a time scale of about a million years. So these are rather disparate time scales. One expects that there shouldn't be any thermal emission. You shouldn't have a hot neutron star on a time scale of 10-8 years. And so there can't be any thermal emission coming forward, or it was thought there can't be any thermal emission coming from the core of the neutron star. The conclusion from this, which was what people have been relying on observationally, was that accretion must have been occurring over a fraction of the surface of the neutron star, somehow constrained to land over an area about a kilometer radius. After this initial detection, there have been additional detections in a number of these systems, Aquila-X1, 4U21-29-47, 4U16-8-5-22, Rapid Burster, 7U31-235, and 7U48-676. Most of them where the measurements could be taking place. The best ones are Aquila-X1, 4U21-29, 16U08, and 17U40 to some extent. Most of them had radii around a kilometer. Black body temperature is also very similar, and luminosity is also in a similar range. So this leads to the question, well, if you have accretion occurring onto a small fraction of the surface of the neutron star, there must be some mechanism for mediating that. And there has to be some mechanism for setting that accretion rate, and there has to be some mechanism for determining what the radius of that accretion will fall over a neutron star. And this wasn't really understood, and it wasn't explained. It's an actual observational problem.
I'm just trying to slow you down.
Thank you.
First of all, these were X-ray detections, I assume, since you're quoting temperatures in the X-ray.
That's correct. They were all X-ray detections.
Yeah. And can you just remind
so
me what the instrument was?
Oh, so the this
four
this
set, wasn't it?
Yes. Some of them were ROSAT, but the first one was SONX-4 was with. There was earlier data with Einstein, yes, but the first detection, I think, came with Exosat, with the CMA.
Mm-hmm. How do you get that age, estimated age, 10 to the years?
It's an argument on the basis that the companion of the star is slightly evolved off the main sequence, and is a low-mass star.
Mm-hmm.
So it can't be a young system like 10 to the 6 years, because the evolutionary time scales for the low-mass stars are more like 100 million years.
Mm-hmm.
And so that sets a general age scale for it.
And my system is
unless for some reason the low mass star is evolving dramatically faster than low mass stars that are isolated.
Or if it was a non explosive collapse later on.
I don't quite understand.
if the neutron star formed quietly and preserved the magnet, and this happened recently.
Perhaps, but the low mass companions generally look similar to other low mass companions that are seen, or other low mass stars that are seen in binary systems. Yeah. So generally.
Can you remind us what all the 1 kilometers again?
Yes, that's the black body radius when one fits a black body spectrum to the X-ray spectrum.
And 1 kilometer is meaning the thickness of the atmosphere?
It's the radial size of the emission region at the distance of the system.
So
the idea is that...
Sure. To 1 goes to 4 pi r squared, so
right.
It's either 4.
Okay, right.
So the idea is that if you have a system and you measure, what we measure is just an energy spectrum, and it looks something like this. Right?
Yeah.
That's theoretical. It actually looks something like this. And so you've got a general flux measurement. And so you can figure out, based on the amount of flux that you have, how far, if you know the distance, how large the emission area is.
Okay, so basically saying that only a small fraction of the surface is emitting, since the actual radius of the star is probably like 10 kilometers.
That was the argument.
So
I'm going to tell you it's something different in a minute.
Okay, so that's what... Okay,
yes, but that is the argument.
If the data really that the temperatures are 10 for the KeV, how far down do you actually measure the energy that you actually measure?
That's a very good question. On almost all of the satellites up until last year, the lowest energies were on the order of a KeV.
Which is way above the peak.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. So there's a lot of faith.
There is some faith, but there's also, you can fit the spectra, and there's uncertainties, and the uncertainties for the early data were on a factor of 2, and later data were more like, 10% or so. So it's a well-constrained temperature.
But you still go down to the peak is about 3/10 of it, KeV, and the measuring energy is about 1.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right.
So you don't know that's a black body. That's the point.
That's correct.
The temperature is correct if it's a black body, but you don't know it's a black body.
That's right. That was the interpretation that was applied to it.
Also, how does that 1 square kilometer compare with the band that a flat accretion disk, if that temperature would just in Kepler and accretion disk.
Well, if you have,
because it seems to me it would be pretty thin.
Mm-hmm.
And granted, it would go all around the star, but I can imagine it being 1 square kilometer, especially since you're looking at it by selection out of the plane of the accretion disk, so you're seeing it in an angle.
Right. So in quiescence, it's thought that the accretion disk doesn't go all the way to the surface of the neutron star. And one observational constraint on that is the fact that the optical light is so low, and basically it's dominated by the companion. So during quiescence, the accretion disk isn't going all the way down the surface of the neutron star, and so you're not seeing X-rays from the accretion disk.
Went down to the surface of the neutron star. How much optical light did that provide?
You can actually get 5 magnitudes of optical light brighter than what it is in quiescence, as much as, yeah. So it's really considerable. Matter of fact, many of these transients are now discovered to go into outburst by looking for an increase in their optical flux. And in fact, one sees the increase in the optical flux in some of these systems, the Corlex 1 is one, before one sees the X-ray.
Are the bursts and transients and quiescent emission as well. If one took those parameters and applied them to all the burst and transient sources, would they be consistent with quiescent emission for all of them, with that temperature and area and so forth, or are there objects that show less quiescent or undetectable quiescent emission at a significant level?
I'm not exactly sure what your question is.
Okay, there's a number of objects that show quiescent emission as well as bursts and transients.
Yes.
Okay, but are there a class of objects that show bursts and transients but no quiescent emission?
There, as yet, no neutron star system in which we're certain that the compact object is a neutron star, and in which we have some reasonable constraints on what the distance is, has remained undetected at luminosity below, I think the faintest one is 5 times 10 to 32 or so. So that was the observational situation for these systems. Basically, they're detected in quiescence. They have they're thought to have unusually small black body radii. That wasn't understood. And the luminosities were all similar. Well, one possible answer for the luminosity problem is a source of energy which hadn't been taken to account, and that is deep crustal heating. In these neutron stars, there are a number of reactions which occur both in the inner and outer crust as the matter finds its way from the atmosphere down to the core. And essentially what's happening here is that matter during outburst gets added onto the surface of the neutron star, or at the surface of the neutron star. And as that matter is added, it increases the pressure at lower levels, and that causes these reactions to occur. And these are electron captures in the outer crust, neutron emissions, and a few Pickman nuclear reactions in the inner crust. And all told, these reactions, as the matter element evolves from pure hydrogen or solar metallicity hydrogen and helium at the surface down to free neutrons and protons in the core, this releases on the order of about an MeV and a half per accreted baryon all through the crust.
So did you say neutron emission? So that's sort of like neutron drift?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
So these are the neutron emissions which happen post-neutron drift.
I see. Okay.
In the inner part of the crust. So these are processes that I would guess most people in the room are familiar with, but hadn't been, the energy which is released in those processes hadn't been taken into account in the energy budget for contributing to the quiescent luminosity. So this is, that it should be pointed out also that this is really a small amount of energy compared to the accretion energy, so that for accreting sources, you get about 50 MeV per accreted baryon. So in the accreting sources, it doesn't really contribute much. One shouldn't expect to see any contribution to the luminosity there. But when the accretion shuts off, that provides the opportunity for that emission to be observed. And the way that that works is essentially that the MeV which is released per accreted baryon, most of it goes straight into the core of the neutron star, and that heats up the core on a time scale of around 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 years. If you have these outbursts which occur on time scales of 10 years or so, you release enough energy to heat up the core to a temperature of around 10 to the 8 degrees. And that will provide a X-ray luminosity at the surface, which is comparable to the X-ray luminosities which are observed from these systems, around 10 to 32 ergs or so. That depends on what the accretion rate is, of course. Over here is a plot. We show the ratio of the occurrence time scale to the outburst time scale. And the occurrence time scale is the amount of time between different outbursts. So you can think about that as the total amount of time between outbursts for the particular transient, and the outburst time scale is the amount of time that it's accreting actively, so the length of a single outburst. And then here's the ratio of the quiescent luminosity, which is the luminosity which is measured somewhat below 10 to 34 ergs or so, to the outburst luminosity. Essentially, the idea is that if all the energy, if all the luminosity one is seeing in quiescence is due to this energy released in deep crustal heating, then the amount of luminosity one sees in quiescence should be proportional to the total amount of accretion energy that one has. It's a similar sort of argument that was put forward for the type 1 X-ray bursts when they were first discovered back in the 70s. And essentially, if the amount of energy which is observed from the during quiescence is about an MeV of energy deposited in the core per accreted baryon, one would expect the neutron stars to fall on this line here. And if it's closer to 0.1 MeV, one would expect the neutron stars to fall on this dotted line here. The open circles here are various neutron star transients, SEN-X4, CORLEX-1, 1608, the rapid burster, EXO-748-576. And then the black dots are certain black hole candidates. There's AO620, GS2025, B44SIG, 1705-250. 1543 minus 47, the arrows indicate upper limits on measurements for the quiescent luminosity. And what you can see is that three of the neutron stars are kind of clustered up here on the plot. SEMAX-4 is down here, close to about 0.1, the 0.1 MeV line. EXO-748 minus 676 is rather considerably above it. The black hole candidates are much more scattered across the plot. It's suggestive in this way as a heuristic that this is not so far off as an idea, that we're not orders of magnitude gone in this sort of description, because the neutron stars do tend to hang out in this area up here. They're not over here or over here. The exception, EXO-748-676, has actually been at that luminosity for several years. It's detected daily in the All-Sky Monitor, and it's also highly variable. So it's at a considerably higher luminosity than one expects for no accretion sort of scenario, where the luminosity would be dominated by thermal emission from the core. And so it's most likely accreting actively. So that's very suggestive of the kind of situation that we would expect in this context. So what about the 1 kilometer areas? Well, for these neutron stars, at the low accretion rates that one would need to account for their luminosities, even around 10 to the minus 13 solar masses per year, the metals which are in the atmosphere settle out in a 10 to 100 second time scale just through gravitational stratification. When that happens, that leaves a pure hydrogen photosphere. In the hydrogen photospheres, the dominant scattering is free, goes as near to the third opacity does, or near to the minus third. And so what that does is, when one is looking at a pure hydrogen atmosphere rather than a black body, one sees more high-energy photons from deeper in the atmosphere than from the surface. And so one has more high-energy photons relative to the low-energy photons. If you interpret this spectrum as black body, it increases the temperature rather than from the simple black body temperature, which then causes a decrease in the emission area radius, simply by keeping the luminosity the same, because it's proportional to 2 to the 4th r squared. So by increasing the interpreted temperature in black body, it decreases the black body radius, or the interpreted black body radius. And this can account for the uniform small radii which have been observed from these systems. This is a plot from work we've done analyzing the data which is available on the systems. These points here are interpretations of black body spectra from these spectra. These points here are interpretations for a hydrogen atmosphere spectrum. Here we have Aquila X1. It's set at two different distances because the distance is controversial here. We have 1608 minus 522, SEMAX-4 here, down here, and 4U2129 plus 47. The error bars look a lot larger for the hydrogen atmosphere spectrum than for the black body spectrum, but proportionally they're the same size. And what you see is that, as you expect, and as was pointed out by those who did the theoretical calculations for these spectra, the emission area radius for these systems is systematically larger for all of the neutron stars and quiescence that are observed. And they are interestingly consistent with what one does expect for the emission area radius from a neutron star within the constraints of the quality of the data.
Would you expect a hydrogen atmosphere to be left after the previous actively accreting bursting phase? Mm-hmm. Enough hydrogen to be left to actually create a hydrogen-rich photosphere?
Well,
it's just, I mean,
so most of what
remembering that an iron atmosphere is closer to a black body, or am I totally wrong?
So most of what one accretes, of course, from the companion is hydrogen. So if everything else settles out from gravitational stratification, then one expects just a pure hydrogen atmosphere.
Right, and if it doesn't burn in a burst?
If it doesn't burn in the burst and blow off the upper atmosphere.
So is that
is that a possible scenario?
I
haven't really considered the possibility of having the outer atmosphere blown off through an explosive event towards the end of its outburst, because of course what would have to happen is, as the accretion rate decreases, as you know, the burst rate will probably decrease as well, and what's more is you also get
more powerful bursts, right?
Type 1 X-ray bursts? Yeah. No, that's not what
the accretion rate decreases. Don't you build up a bigger pile before you go?
If it does happen, that's generally not, that, I'm not really aware of statistics for that, and from observations of the rapid burster, for example, it's the exact opposite. The really strong type 1 X-ray bursts come out at the peak of the outburst.
I think one thing to say, you know, the photosphere is only 10 grams per square centimeter.
Yeah, I mean, that's
so this is only 10 to the 14 grams of material.
Right, so you don't need much hydrogen.
There is no way you can not have it. Right. There's no way you can burn and then not accrete that little bit of 10 to the, 10 to the minus 26 grams.
Is the instant emission also, you know, 10 to the 7th degrees temperature?
It's slightly cooler. You can see here, I'm sorry, I didn't explain this very well. This is the effective temperature on this axis. This is the effective radius on this axis. And you can see the temperatures, which are black body up here, are 0.2 to 0.3 keV. In hydrogen atmosphere spectrum, they're around 0.1, 0.2. So the temperatures are lower as well. But that would be known. That was also known from the theoretical work before.
You know, that accretion rate, especially if you're only getting one MeV per nucleon,
how?
I mean, that's 10 in the minus, roughly 10 in the minus 5 anything.
So what's happening here is that the emission that we're seeing is not due to accretion. The emission that we're seeing...
I understand that. Mm-hmm. That's my point.
Okay.
But the amount of matter you're getting is... Well, I guess my question is, how much matter are you assuming is getting dumped on?
Oh, one can measure the amount of matter.
How much is it?
So it's
100 times?
Yeah, I mean, this is what this plot up here shows. So this quiescent luminosity here is proportional to the amount of, this outburst luminosity here times the outburst time scale is the amount of matter that one...
Time-integrated transient luminosity is 100 times 4 times 10 to 33. It's like 10 to 35,
10 to 36.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I see.
Right.
Yeah. Which means that the high P is a big difference.
No, because that occurs at the surface, and the reactions which occur are you know, really, you know, far gone from helium. They're all post-iron. Oh, for the spectrum, yes. It would dramatically affect the spectrum. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well,
you can calculate a helium spectrum, I mean, and one would know what it is. The assumptions we've made so far are that it's hydrogen. And given the fact that these are normal low-mass companions and not white dwarfs, it seems a reasonable one. I'm sorry, you had a question.
Yeah, in your diagram, you have some black hole candidates. With detections, not just upper limits.
That's right.
Do you get very much larger emitting areas? Not worried that this is a...
So that's a good question about the black holes, but I want to stay with the neutron stars for now. That's
well,
okay.
The question is only, you know, are they a distinct class? So you're not, so they don't.
Yeah, this is actually work that we did already. We looked at the black holes in an identical sort of rubric and to see if one interpreted them as neutron stars, if one could make the mistake of thinking they were neutron stars. And there are three detections. Two of them are rather distinct from the neutron stars that are observed, and so one would say that they were different at least in some way. Well, one of them is statistically consistent, but with huge error bars. So observationally, it is a promising way for distinguishing black holes and neutron stars if one assumes the neutron star spectrum in quiescence. So I want to point out that observationally there are a couple of caveats that have to be taken into consideration. One is that there are highly uncertain distances on the order of factors of two or more. But we've got the Space Interferometric Mission, which is coming up in a few years. That can measure the distances to their companions, which have magnitudes of 18 to 21 or so, to 1% or on that order. Also, the column density. This is something which every observer really rues, and that is that most of the emission comes out below keV, but the column density causes a lot of absorption down there. And so one really needs to pick one's sources as well as possible to try to avoid high column density sources, but we have to take what's given to us essentially by the Milky Way. And in quiescence, because the emission rate is so low, one has to use the column density observed from other means, either from outburst or potentially the optically implied column density as well. So it's something that we worry about. In quiescence, Chandra and XMM are actually quite able to measure the column density simultaneously with the spectrum, so that overcomes that difficulty. One also has to keep in mind that intensity variability could be taking place on timescales of days to month. There could be accretion which is active, and so one has to think about that when one is interpreting these spectra. And on top of that, there's an additional Howard power law component which has been observed in Quillex-1 and Senex-4. It's power law which becomes dominant in the spectrum above about 2 keV, and so that's an additional spectral component which adds uncertainty to the spectral fits. I would also point out that since this work was done, there have been discoveries of two pulsars in quiescence. One of them is a well-known one, AO535. Another one is an equally well-known one, SACJ1808.4, which is the famous low-mass X-ray binary pulsar. Both of them have similar luminosities to the scale as expected. The kind of argument that I put forward earlier for what should heat the core holds for pulsars or for transient pulsars as well as for low magnetic field objects. So although the spectrum will be perturbed by the magnetic field, one still expects the same kinds of luminosities in quiescence.
Do they still pulse in quiescence?
Sorry?
Do they still pulse by
essence? Yes. SACJ1808, both of these were observed as pulsars.
How hard does the hard power law on Quillex-1 and Senex-4 go to?
It's detected about up to, well, it's detected in the pass band of the instrument, so like 5 keV.
These are soft X-ray. Oh, 5 keV.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And they're, it depends. They have a slope of like, In the earlier OSCE observations, they have a slope of like 2, 1.5 or so.
In photon.
So that's deep crustal heating. The question was raised, is there really no accretion in quiescence? Observationally, there's reason to believe that there is accretion in quiescence, and that is that there is intensity variability, which is observed in these systems on timescales of days to month. So unless the neutron star is getting larger and smaller on timescales of days to month, or something else is contributing to the emission of the neutron star, that can, at present time, best be explained as active accretion in quiescence. On the other hand, accretion could be hindered by what's called the propeller effect. That's when the magnetic field of the neutron star, the magnetosphere, gets larger, so large that it is out beyond the co-rotation radius in the accretion disk, and because the magnetic field is now spinning faster than the matter, it propellers it off into infinity or somehow constrains the accretion onto the surface of the neutron star. And there's observational evidence in at least one source, Quillex-1, that that's actually happening. So it's a question whether any accretion is falling onto the surface or whether some small fraction of accretion is making its way to the surface.
Excuse me, what is the nature of that evidence?
The nature of that evidence are observations by Campana with Beppo Sachs and Zhang et al. With XTE during an outburst in 1998. Campana observed the luminosity of the source to change. This is time. Or rather log time, and here's the intensity. He observed the luminosity to kind of drop off by an order of magnitude over a time scale of about 20 days, and three orders of magnitude in the time scale of 3 days. And then it was flat for several observations thereafter. This was a luminosity of around 10 to the 35 ergs per second. And this is the luminosity of 10 to 33 ergs per second, which is the quiescent luminosity for the source. So the idea, the interpretation of this was that here accretion was simply decreasing onto the neutron star until the magnetic field got larger than the co-rotation radius and suddenly inhibited accretion over that 3-day time scale until it reached the quiescent luminosity, which we interpret as being due to a hot thermal core. Zhang, on the other hand, during the same period with observations with XTE, observed the spectrum, and this is so here we take a hardness ratio. Now, here we have a hardness ratio. and again with the same time axis. And what he observed was that the hardness ratio was really constant until this change in luminosity occurred, and there the hardness ratio suddenly kind of took off out to, excuse me, not over this time. This is actually not. Excuse me.
I've messed the time out. Hardness ratio or a
this is a hard X-ray hardness ratio, and this time is incorrect. So during this 3-day period, though, it was observed to get continually harder and harder.
So this power law component became.
That's one interpretation of it. But it was not observed at the quiescent level. It's too faint for XTE to detect at the quiescent level. So the interpretation of those observations are that the propeller effect is what's kicking in. That's been observed once. Quillex 1 goes off every 6 months or so. So it's really needed to be confirmed with a second observation of the same kind of phenomenology to really shore up that interpretation.
Okay, thank you.
About the first point there, can you tell whether there is a luminosity floor above which all the variability happens? So does it shut off completely at some point?
Well, it kind of depends on what you determine to be, I mean, what you define as a luminosity floor. Generally, for all of these systems, the number of observations that have been made of them in quiescence, the number of detections, can be counted on one hand or fewer. So what counts as a floor is the lowest one. So this spectrum here is kind of the observer's view of the spectrum. I'll show you a better comparison of the two later on. But this is what one would expect to see with XMM for two different theoretical spectra from Aquila X1. The lower one is a hydrogen atmosphere spectrum. The upper one is a metallic spectrum. They're normalized to the luminosity, which have been observed from these systems prior to Chandra and XMM being launched, which was all above 0.5 keV or so. And what one can see is that there's a rather dramatic difference between these two spectra, which I'll show you in a little bit better detail in the next view graph. But the idea here is simply that if accretion is occurring in quiescence, these deviations from smooth continuum are due to metallic absorption lines in the photosphere. And if one can detect these metallic absorption lines, one then has a redshift at the photosphere of the neutron star, and one has a ratio of the mass to radius. And you combine that with the radius that's observed from the normalization of the spectrum, and you have a mass and radius point on the equation of state plot. So this is a more detailed comparison between the two spectra, so you can get some feel for what really is going on. This axis is energy. This axis is log flux at about a kiloparsecs. These are spectra which are calculated by our collaborator, Vyacheslav Zoblin. He'll be here later this year, I believe. The line up here is the smooth hydrogen atmosphere spectrum. It's basically continuum. And the line below that is a solar metallicity. The kind of metallicity which is solar, which no other star seems to have as high, but again, it's the metallicity which is common to stars. And one can see that there's quite a bit of absorption, quite a number of absorption lines which pop their head up in these spectra, including an edge which caused the dramatic difference below 1 keV that you saw in the previous view graph. And that edge is really responsible for where one, at least at a first cut, hopes to make detection. Well, if one makes a detection of that edge, one can measure the redshift using that edge specifically. But there are a lot of other smaller lines which larger area instruments could potentially pick up. Just so you know where we've been so far, OSCA generally had bandpass that was north of 0.8 keV. ROSAP PSBC had bandpass, which is down to 0.4 keV, but the energy resolution was rather large, on the order of 50% or so. Chandra, for example, and XMM is similar, pops down to here to around 0.2 keV and maybe 0.3 keV. It's down by about a third in its area, and its delta E over E is around 120 to 200 in that range. So its spectral resolution is good enough to be able to, its spectral resolution at its area is good enough such that it can both detect these features and resolve them. Not the smallest ones, but the edge.
You probably don't know the answer to this question.
Okay.
What was the physics that went into it? I mean, this is an unfair question, probably.
Yeah.
Because you didn't do these calculations. But
right.
Did these calculations really include pressure broadening and all the...
They did not include... They didn't include pressure broadening. But this is something, yeah, that I would refer you to Vyacheslav to get the detailed answers on.
The star spinning
This one is not spinning, but the neutron stars that we are that are observed are almost certainly spinning. One of them, Aquilex 1, has a measured spin period during a type 1 X-ray burst around 580 hertz, I think it is. Absolutely. And not included here. Absolutely. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's why the edge is the more important feature of the photonization edge. That also wasn't brought out.
But it does dramatically impact the, you know, it does make a big difference between that and the hydrogen atmosphere spectrum. So, I won't skip that. Cutting to the promising future, we already know that globular clusters produce a lot of neutron stars. They're overabundant in globular clusters, or at least accreting neutron stars are overabundant in globular clusters by a factor of 100 or so over the disk. And it's well known that there are a class of low luminosity X-ray sources in globular clusters. It's somewhat controversial about what they are. On their discovery, it was suggested they are cataclysmic variables. Soon after, it was suggested that perhaps they're neutron stars in quiescence. This is even before the first transient neutron star was discovered, so this kind of predated that. And on top of that, they could also be RSCVN systems, which are slightly evolved binary systems, low mass systems. All of these have comparable luminosities on the level of 10 to 32 Earth per second or so. But their spectra in the globular clusters, at least, are not well constrained observationally at the present time, although that will change shortly with globular clusters. The kinds of sources, well, these sources at luminosities of down to 10 to 31 ergs or so will be detectable and already are detectable with the present instrumentation and even better with Constellation X. So we expect that both the present instrumentation and future X-ray spectroscopy will permit to spectrally distinguish between neutron stars, cataclysmic variables, RSCVNs, and be able to measure the radius accuracy to the distance of the globular cluster. And so it's this distance which is really important to overcome. In the case of the low-mass X-ray binaries, which are in the plane, the distances are really highly uncertain by like a factor of 2. And the distances to the globular cluster at the present time are much more well-known. Also, they are at a uniform column density, and so one can jointly fit all the spectra and fit to that better. So it overcomes an observational uncertainty there. Tim, did you have a question?
No.
So to conclude, so the non-equilibrium reactions which can heat the neutron star core during the outburst, they can provide full 10 to 32, 10 to 33 Earth per second luminosity, which is observed in quiescence. The transient neutron stars will be detecting quiescence even if there are no accretion occurring. The hydrogen atmosphere spectrum produce emission area which are consistent with the entire neutron star surface area. And the hydrogen atmosphere spectroscopy permits a determination of the ratio of the radius of the emission area to the distance of the neutron star. If there is accretion occurring in quiescence, the metal lines can provide a measure of the redshift at the photosphere. And both of these combined can give a point on the equation of state figure. The low luminosity X-ray sources are very promising candidates for the study of these atmospheres because of the uniform distance and column density. And so they can potentially really help nail down the neutron star equation of state with present and future instrumentation. Thank you.
I don't know if you answered this and I missed it or didn't answer it. What confines the emission to a small area of the surface?
Yeah. This was the former observational misunderstanding which occurred from the neutron stars. And the misunderstanding was this. Because they were interpreting the X-ray spectra which were observed as black body.
Oh, I see. But this is the atmosphere.
Exactly. Once you fit the spectra with the hydrogen atmosphere spectrum, then the radii become larger. They get larger up. They become consistent with the full radius of the neutron star.
In fusion, this doesn't touch the neutron star in quiescence. So how does the instability get started?
It's thermal instability in the
inner disk
or the outer disk.
I mean.
So there are actually a number of mechanisms.
What radius is the thermal instability supposed to take place?
It's like 10 to the 5 Schwarzschild radius. It's way out there.
It's a dwarf node.
And that's enough?
It's the dwarf node incident.
And that's enough to affect what happened?
Sorry, so matter's being dumped into the outer accretion disk. It's piling up there. Eventually, you get thermal instability in the outer disk, and that's into matter. It's just the
all the way in. All the way in from
sure, there. Sure, but that's the you know, the bottleneck's always a large radius. Right, for an accretion disk. So.
There are other cases of isolated pulsar electric particles.
The isolated neutron stars?
No,
they're about
also
7 now.
Attempts to remain on to try to estimate the number of cases of neutron stars. The size of the hole. Anywhere from the hundredth of what was expected to what was expected, depending on the
so I think.
This is a matter also. I think
that you're referring to the neutron star which is observed. Oh. So that's an isolated neutron star. Yeah, I'm not really sure about that spectrum. The distance of the isolated neutron stars tend to be very rather uncertain, although a couple of them have been nailed down to a factor of 2 or so. I don't really have an interpretation of their photospheres because they're going to be very different from these neutron stars, since these neutron stars are always accreting fresh matter from, you know, largely hydrogen matter from their companion, and those neutron stars could be simply the remnant left over from a supernova.
These are radio pulsars, so they have other ways of getting distance.
Okay. Yeah.
So in the case of 0.37, I believe that one has worked on that spectrum. So it's the same collaborator has definitely worked on that object.
Okay.
The thing to say is the radio pulsar people were well aware of this dope use of black line. The X-ray community and accretion was not. So there were, you know, 10 years went by with theory which Bob didn't elaborate on about how to get a 1 kilometer emitting area. At the point is that there's no reason to worry about it. You can realize that that is going to be the technical things.
Could you say a little more about the evidence for accretion and quiescence and variability? I think the evidence was variability of the quiescent emission.
That's right.
What's the fraction?
It's about a factor of 3 over time scales of days to months. That's been observed in SEN-X4 and ACRO-X1. No, not for the signal-to-noise spectrum, for the low signal-to-noise spectra which were available previously. I think with Chandra we'll be able to do much better, though. As a matter of fact, with Chandra I know we'll be able to do much better. Once we get a factor of 3, if we have a factor of 3 difference in the luminosity of Chandra, we'll be able to detect spectral variability very well. And we have a program to do that with the Quillex 1.